Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. That beautiful voice belongs to operatic diva Angela Brown, and she is coming to southeastern Wisconsin the first weekend in May for a couple of different presentations called Opera from a Sista's Point of View. And I'm very excited to have this opportunity to reconnect with Angela Brown. I actually spoke with her on the morning show one time before this when she came to Milwaukee to sing the role of Giuseppe Verdi's Aida at the Milwaukee Florentine Opera, a performance which I got to experience in person and very, very much enjoyed. And I know that this presentation that she's going to be doing here in southeastern Wisconsin is going to be very inspiring and humorous and uplifting and educational as she sort of lets us into the real-life adventures of someone who is a professional singer at the highest echelons of the world of opera. Angela Brown, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you. I'm so happy to be here and speaking with you again.
This is a great pleasure for me. Remind us, I know we talked about this during that first conversation, but that was a few years ago. Tell us where you came from originally, and at what point during what I presume was a childhood that had some music in it, at what point music started to become really important to you, and especially the matter of singing?
Well, I'm from Indianapolis, Indiana, and I grew up in my grandfather's Baptist church, and at five, that was my first stage. And I would sing all through, you know, grade school, grammar school, high school, and I did a lot of community theater here in Indianapolis. But it wasn't until I went to Oakwood University in Huntsville, Alabama, that I found I had this voice for opera music. I took to the technique of classical singing like a duck to water, and my teacher took me then to the studios of Virginia Zayani at Indiana University, and she took me into her studio. So I always say my teacher, Ginger Beasley, is the author of my voice, but Virginia Zayani was the finisher of my voice, and she polished this rough diamond into a diamond, and I've been able to sing on the stages of the world ever since.
When you were first told that maybe your destiny was to be more of a classical singer, more of an opera singer, what was your initial reaction? I mean, was that a world completely unknown to you, and were you at all hesitant or maybe even resistant to the notion that instead of singing those beloved hymns from your grandpa's church, you were maybe going to be called upon to sing an entirely different kind of music? I mean, how did you react to that possibility?
Well, classical music was something that I was familiar with. I had been exposed to it, but I never thought that I would sing it. And upon hearing that I had that option, I was resistant, yeah, like most young people, when it's something that is not a steady diet for you and something that you're not necessarily used to, and you feel like everybody is going to shun you because you're walking around singing all up in the rafters, and they're like, girl, what's that, you know? Yeah, you're a little apprehensive. But as I began to work with classical music and making it more my own, I found, because I love the stage anyway, I'd done a lot of musical theater, I'd done like some straight theater, and I love the stage. And opera just added a deeper component to that because you sang everything, you know. And I was able to use everything that I already had in it. So it was easy in that respect, but I did have to get over some quote-unquote mental hurdles, so to speak, because of the peer pressure.
Hmm. Tell us a little bit about working with Virginia Zaidani. And, of course, that may not be a familiar name to the vast majority of our listeners, but anybody who follows the world of opera knows that Virginia Zaidani was a very, very fine operatic artist in her own right, and one of the figures, in a sense, from opera's golden age. What kind of things, what are the most important things that you learned from that great teacher?
Well, it was a joy, first of all, to work with Virginia Zaidani. And at times it was a little daunting, a little intimidated, because she was very sure and very direct with you. She didn't like to waste her time, and she didn't want to waste yours. So she told you what she felt on the drop of a dime. But in that, there was still love, because I think it's important for me, for a student to know if they should pursue or not. And Ms. Zaidani was very, very instrumental in me getting out here. She let me know one time I went into her studio. And the first time that I met Ms. Zaidani, she told me, Bibi, I was a mezzo soprano. And she said, Bibi, you are not a mezzo soprano. You are a dramatic soprano. The blood of Verdi courses through your veins. You come to me when you're done with Ginger, and I'll take you in my studio. Then years later, after I had, you know, was about to leave her studio, I came into her studio kind of forlorn and just trying to figure out what it was I was going to do with this gift that the Lord had given me. And I was telling her that I wanted to just be a concert singer. I didn't think I wanted to tackle the stage of opera. And she says, darling, if you want to be the next Aretha Franklin, go. You need no more lessons. But if you want to be the greatest Verdi and soprano this world has ever known, you must work. And from that point on, I no longer doubted necessarily what this gift that I was given. You know, everything can be encased in fear from time to time. And she actually gave me the kick in the pants that I needed to get out there and at least try it.
Hmm.
And it worked. So,
do you ever wonder what might have happened, how your life would be different if you had decided, well, okay, I'll be the next Aretha Franklin instead? Or by and large, do you feel completely confident that this was the right choice to make for you?
I feel completely confident that I was going to be a singer, regardless. This was my destiny, and I was born to do this. Whatever genre I had picked up, just so happened that opera was something that I really, it was just another palette color to what I was already doing. So it's what worked for me and got me out here. I still can be the next Aretha Franklin if I want to. So, you know, I knew that I was destined to sing, and opera was just what ushered me into the world of entertainment.
I know from hearing your album called Mosaics, and from hearing your part of a really fine recording of highlights from Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, and from hearing you sing Verdi's Aida on the stage of the Milwaukee Florentine, that you are someone who is very comfortable in a variety of styles. unlike some opera singers who really probably shouldn't venture outside the confines of opera at all, because that's what they know how to do well and not so much these other things. Talk for a moment about that versatility, if that is something that you have consciously nurtured, or if that's just maybe a gift you were born with.
Well, I will say it's both. It was definitely a gift I was born with, because I started, like I said before, singing in my grandfather's Baptist church at 5. And then I went on to sing a lot of musical theater and a lot of R&B. I was even the vocal coach for the IU Soul Review while I was in college, in university there at IU. And so it was something that innately I did. I could do it. And I guess I nurtured it because I never threw it away. You know, there are a lot of teachers that are like, you have to make a choice. And when you're in the career, you do have to make a choice to sing, if you're going to sing classical music or operatic music, repertoire, you do have to make a choice to keep the voice in line, keep it clean and high, you know. But as you are in this career a little longer, you find that you want to enjoy all aspects of your life and your voice, so you can have opportunities to explore those things that you have put in your back pocket. I think every singer out here today, old and new, should always have an arsenal of things, because the opera landscape is changing and the tastes are changing. And if you can be versatile in your offerings and still give integrity to the voice and the genre that you are singing, then I think it's more than responsible for you to use everything that you got. Why not? Have fun. This is entertainment. It's not, you know, brain surgery. Opera is just entertainment. So, yeah, I use everything that God has given me.
Tell us about the experience of singing in various houses, including the Metropolitan Opera, where you made quite a splash in the role of Verdi's Aida. I mean, kind of coming in relatively last minute, I understand, and scoring a really great triumph there. But, of course, you've sung in a lot of other opera houses all over the world. Just talk for a moment about that experience of never being in the same place all that long, and of singing in all kinds of different places with all kinds of different colleagues, each one having their own sort of personality and atmosphere, I should think. What is that experience like, and do you like everything about it?
Well, you know, singing in different opera houses around the world is just that. You're singing in different opera houses around the world. So you're going to have different people with different tastes and different cultures. And so you have to find yourself being a chameleon and adjusting all the time. But the one thing that rings true constantly is your musicianship and you as a person. So if you are coming prepared and you can get along with the people, your situation doesn't have to be hard wherever you find yourself. I had a great time singing at the Metropolitan. It was exciting. It was a heady time, and I find myself back there from time to time, singing all over the world. It's all about just adjusting to climate, to having enough time to get there and adjust to the time change, you know, when you're singing overseas especially. And then you run into rehearsal halls and theaters that might be a little musty, dusty. So you have to make sure you always have your medication with you if you have allergies and things. And hydration and sleep. All of those things can help you just, you know, because no one wants to be around a crabby singer, you know, because that crabby singer is feeling crabby because they're not necessarily either prepared or they're overtired. And you just have to make sure you take care of yourself. So I've had very pleasant and positive experiences in all of my travels, because I just remember that I'm human and I take it one day at a time.
Hmm. The title of the presentation that you're doing in Racine and Kenosha is called Opera from a Sista's Point of View. And I think that title tells us probably a fair amount about what this presentation is going to be about and the kind of things you're likely to share. Tell us about this presentation and what people can expect to enjoy in it.
Well, opera from a sister's point of view is just a concert that I do to demystify opera for audiences that normally wouldn't go. Because our opera audiences are changing all the time. When I started this show, I was looking out in the audience from the stage, and I would see very few people that looked like me. And I asked myself why. And it could be a number of things from, you know, economics, they just simply can't afford it, to they're intimidated because of the language and they have preconceived notions that everybody's running around toe-to-toe and with horns on their head and a breastplate and the spear. And so I just try to dispel some of that. And I basically come from a tongue-in-cheek, fun, witty point of view where I am talking about the aria that I'm about to sing, and I'm telling you what's happening in the action of the opera at that time. And I just make it fun, and I use today's vernacular, and you might see me dance a little bit, and, you know, I'm definitely going to crack you up because I love to laugh. You know, it's all life. And opera, you can find yourself in an opera if you look at Aida. I don't care how many people they paint up to be African. Aida is an African opera with African peoples. Egypt and Ethiopia are in the dark continent of Africa. So I let you know that you can find yourself there. You can find yourself in Seville, in Carmen. It's a Hispanic opera. You find yourself in Tosca, Italian opera. It goes on and on and on. You can find yourself, so you don't have to be intimidated. And I try to make it comfortable. I don't dumb it down because even though you might be laughing, when I start singing, you won't be laughing. You'll know there is some seriousness there. But I try to make it entertaining and palatable for all audiences.
Hmm. You know, you've made a really interesting point just now. About making something accessible versus dumbing it down. And I never stopped to think about that, but that's probably kind of a tricky little balancing act to achieve, to make something, an art form as richly complex as opera accessible without, in a sense, simplifying it to the point where it isn't what it is anymore. But I have a feeling that once you do this a while, you find sort of where that line is.
Because, you know, opera is about relationships. It's about people. It's about people being in love. It's about people being mad about people being in love. It's about jealousy. It's real. Opera is really a very blue-based art form if you really peel the onion. If you take the time to read the plot synopsis, honey, this is the best empire and scandal you can find on the stage. You know, and it's just regular. And I think opera gets a bad rap as far as being, you know, something that you can't understand because it has always been done for the most part for the elite, for the rich, for those that have had money. But it really started off with very regular, common folk. And then it just depended on where you found yourself listening to it, in the palace or in a piazza under the stars. Mm. It just depended, you know. So it's really not that deep.
Right. Well, and meant for everyone. I mean, everyone has the possibility of enjoying this. Angela Brown is going to be coming to Southeastern Wisconsin, a presentation Saturday at St. Luke's Episcopal Church from 4 to 6. That's right downtown Racine, a beautiful space to sing. And then Sunday, May 3rd, 5 to 6, she'll be doing the same presentation at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church in downtown Kenosha. Her presentation, Opera from a Sista's Point of View. And if you want more information, you can contact either the Racine Public Library about Saturday's presentation or the Kenosha Public Library about Sunday's presentation. Angela Brown, what a great pleasure to reconnect with you, and I'm so glad you're coming to the area. I look forward to seeing your presentation for myself, and I know a lot of people are going to derive great pleasure from it. And I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show and wish you many more years of happy singing.
Thank you so much. God bless. See you all soon.
And now we're going to sample the program which soprano Angela Brown is going to be presenting here in southeastern Wisconsin under the auspices of the Kenosha Public Library and the Racine Public Library, a program which is called Opera from a Sista's Point of View, in which she takes the audience through some of the most beautiful and intense arias which she sings and introduces them in her own inimitable way. The presentations are going to be occurring Saturday, May 2nd, 4 to 6 in the afternoon at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in downtown Racine, 614 Main Street. And then on Sunday, May 3rd in Kenosha, 5 to 6 at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church, which is located right on Library Square in downtown Kenosha. Here is a sample of what you can expect, what promises to be a beautiful and lighthearted and ultimately inspirational journey into the wonderful world of opera with soprano Angela Brown.
You know, now I tend to sing a lot of roles. With sisters in trouble, they're always crying and praying. They have a whole lot of angst and strife in their lives. We're going to talk about Miss Amelia in Ballo, the Masked Ball. Now, Miss Amelia is in love with her husband's best friend. Uh-huh, that's the mess right there, okay? There's a problem. So, you know, they don't know that they're, like, he doesn't know she really is in love with him, and she doesn't know or the other one doesn't know. You understood what I just said? They don't know that they're in love with each other, but they're in love with each other. I told you opera is crazy. All right, so she goes to Ulrika, a witch, to get a magic potion to take the love from her heart from this forbidden man. Well, she gets to this desolate dog place, and she's got to pick this magic herb. Just as she's about to pick this magic herb, guess who shows up? Her boyfriend, or her pretend boo, okay? The boo in her head, okay? Shows up, her husband's best friend. And he's professing all this love to her. And she's going, no, I can't do it. I can't besmirch the good name of my husband. He was like, oh, come on, just one time, basically, you know? So anyway, just as she's about to besmirch it, why you up here, just about the time she's about to get it on, guess who shows up? Her husband shows up. So she has what I think is a tissue thin veil that she puts over her head. Now all of a sudden, nobody can tell who she is, okay? So they sing this trio, and, you know, because the reason why her husband came in the first place is because, you know, her husband and her boyfriend in her head are best friends. So he's coming to tell him he's got to get away because some conspirators are coming to kill him. So he says, okay, man, now I tell you, I'm going to leave, but this lady I have with me that you don't know who she is, you don't notice the dress that you bought her last Christmas. And she don't have on any gloves, okay? So it's his hand with the ring that he bought her. Whatever. She just got this little veil on. Don't lift her veil. Get her safely back to the city, and I'm going to trust that you'll do that because you're my best friend. He says, no problem, honey. No problem. No problem. I'll get him back. Get her back. It's not going to be a problem. So he leaves as they're about to leave, and he's about to take his wife safely back to town. The conspirators come in. They have a little fight. Amelia doesn't want her husband to get killed, so she lifts the veil and takes it off, and he goes, Amelia! I mean, it's funny. It's one of the funniest parts in opera. I'm like you really didn't know. So, anyway, they start to tease him and mock him and laugh at him. Well, you know, this really is not a good thing for Amelia because he's getting madder and madder and madder. So he takes her at the end of that act and drags her home. So he gets her home in the study, throws her in, and he says, I'm gonna kill you, I'm gonna kill you, I'm gonna kill you. And she's going, boo-boo, I'm gonna tell you, it was like this. Now see, this is what had happened. Well, see, I was trying to get this herb. He said, I'm gonna kill you, I'm gonna kill you, I'm gonna kill you. And she says, well, no, now wait, now, if you're gonna kill me, well, at least let me see my son one more time. Let him kiss me on the cheek. If his daddy is going to kill me, just let me see him one more time. That's all that Moreau, my prima in grazia, is about. She's begging for her life, child. And you got to come to the opera to see if it works. Moreau, my prima in grazia.
Oh,
soprano Angela S. Brown, and an excerpt from her program, which is called Opera from a Sister's Point of View. It will be presented Saturday, May 2nd, 4 o'clock at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in downtown Racine, and also Sunday, May 3rd, 5 in the afternoon at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church in downtown Kenosha. And the event is free. You can get tickets for it at the Racine Public Library or the Kenosha Public Library, respectively. Give them a call if you have a question. Now we turn back the clock to several years ago when I first got to speak with Angela Brown on the morning show. The occasion was her performance at the Milwaukee Florentine of Giuseppe Verdi's Aida, the opera with which she made a very triumphant Met debut not long before. Here's an excerpt from that earlier conversation as she describes that experience of debuting at the Metropolitan Opera.
Well, actually, I was slated to have my debut as Aida, and actually I just did my debut performance, but what's been the kicker here when it's been reported is that everyone thinks that I just stepped out on the stage. It did happen 2 days after my performance and after my debut that I did have to step in for a colleague, and then I ended up doing several more of the Aidas in the run. But it was a very exciting opportunity and one that I will never forget.
Tell us what it is like to be on that stage and to sing in a room, so to speak, where so many other tremendous artists, including Leontine Price, have sung and have sung that very role.
You know, it's the most exhilarating, phenomenal feeling to know that great performers that have come before you have actually stepped on those same floorboards. When I was still in school and auditioning for the Met Young Artist Program, and when I finally made it to the finals after four tries, I remember going and touching the floorboards and caressing the curtains and saying, one day I'll be back, I'll be back. So it's the most exciting thing that any performer in this profession could experience.
Hmm. One thing that I could not help but notice, I've seen a spectacular photograph of you outside the Met, mm-hmm. pointing at the big sort of billboard which lists the cast, and you're pointing to it with a great glee, and there's the big sold-out banner up at the top of it. Right below your name is Aida. Angela M. Brown is the Omneris for that performance, Dolores Zajac, who many would regard as maybe the greatest Omneris in recent history. I mean, just an extraordinary artist. I'm just wondering, in addition to the intimidation of singing in this spectacular temple of opera, but also to go head-to-head, Aida Omneris, with as formidable an artist as Dolores Zajac. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, you know, I didn't feel any of the angst that you have just described because I didn't have time. She's such a gracious, beautiful colleague. I mean, me and Ms. Zajac had a lot of fun just laughing, and actually I got a chance to meet her in San Francisco when I was covering Leonora in Il Trovatore. So the ice had been broken, so to speak. I had already met her. So it was quite comfortable to sing with her. And, you know, when you're in the moment, you just do your job, because I've been programmed to do my job. But a lot of people told me that a lot of sparks were flying during that duet. So,
Tell us a little bit about the home in which you grew up, a home which apparently had some music in it, but I've heard you say not in the traditional sense.
No, not in the traditional sense of classical music or anything. I grew up in a Christian home. There wasn't even a lot of gospel played in my home. My mother loved R&B music, and she wanted to be an entertainer when she was younger, but she opted to have, you know, to get married and have us, so she became a mother, and she had other occupations that she had. But so she loved R&B, and she would take us to musical theater. She loved musical theater. So we saw a lot of musical theater at the Starlight Musicale, I believe it was, in Indianapolis, and
all the groups that came through, you know, we would see from the OJs, the Gladys Knight. If there was a musical that came in, you know, we went to go see that. So that's the kind of thing that I grew up with. And then later on, I began to become more immersed in gospel music. And much later after that, classical music.
I have read that you did not begin formal voice lessons until you were 21 years old. Ahead of that, I mean, were you someone who sang in the choir at school or sang at church or, I mean, did a substantial amount of singing just without studying?
I sang at the opening of an envelope. I mean, I've been singing since I've been singing since I was 5 years old in my grandfather's Baptist church in Indianapolis. And then in grammar school, in grade school, in high school, I did lots of musical theater. I was in Guys and Dolls. I was in Jesus Christ Superstar. I was, you name it, I was in it. Then after I graduated high school, I got into community theater. So my background was heavy into musical theater. So I had been well-versed, had on-the-job training on stage, if you will, from a young age. So stepping into another genre of music as far as classical was different, but it was also comfortable. I had to learn the mechanics of being an opera singer. But after that, being on stage was not a problem for me because I'd been doing it.
When did you see your first opera, and what was it?
My first opera, Well, I want to say, well, actually, I was in an opera. I was in Aida.
Really?
When I was just graduated from high school, I was one of the Ethiopians with the Indianapolis Opera. That was, I think, my first opera that I witnessed.
Wow. When you went to college, Oakwood College in Huntsville, Alabama, were you studying music there?
Yes.
Okay. You talk of how your teacher there, Ginger Beasley, was a protege of one of the most renowned voice teachers in the country, and a former opera singer herself by the name of Virginia Tseani.
Yes.
And every year she would truck a whole lot of you all the way from Alabama up to Indiana University for a weekend. And that's where you first encountered this great lady who eventually became your teacher as well. Tell us about those encounters.
Well, you know, it was awe-inspiring because at the time her husband, Nicolae Rossi Lemeni, was still alive, which was one of the great Romanian baritones. He wasn't Romanian, but he was a great baritone.
Mm-hmm.
She's Romanian. Mrs. Ayani is Romanian. Sorry about that. And just being able to be in their presence and for them both to do like a tag team master class with you, you know, within 20 minutes you were fixed, you know. So you knew exactly what you were going to do and go back to school and work on, because I came down to up to Indiana, I should say, being a mezzo soprano, and the first thing Miss Zayani heard me, she was like, "No, darling, you are not a mezzo soprano. You are a Verdian soprano. You come to me, I fix you. I make you the greatest Verdian soprano this world has ever known."
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it was exciting times and also daunting and scary because at the time I don't think I really knew what I was getting myself into.
I guess not. It's a good thing you did get into all that.
Yeah, definitely.
You go on to Indiana University for a graduate work and you begin studying with Virginia Tseani. For the sake of our listeners, we should say that Indiana University is one of the places for a young singer to go if they really are serious about studying opera. But we also hear about it being, in some respects, an incredibly competitive environment because there's just so much incredible talent there. What was your experience in Indiana like?
Well, you know, Indiana is just a slice of what you're going to get, you know, when you get out in the real world. I never felt that much angst about it. I just had blinders on and I did what I had to do. Indiana was a very good experience for me. I had a chance to sing with the dean of the School of Music for Indiana University-related programs, which helped me, you know, loosen my chops up, so to speak, you know, really be able to sing the repertoire that I was meant to sing. I had a chance to do a few shows there. So I didn't really hone into all of that, I'm a little fish in a big pond kind of thing. I didn't put that kind of pressure on myself, because it can be a lot of pressure on a young singer that's really, you know, wanting to do this and wanting to be successful. But I say it's better to be prepared with no opportunity than to have the opportunity and not be prepared.
Well put. Did you ever feel there, and I suppose for that matter, maybe since then, but especially in that kind of environment, just crowded with gifted singers, I'm guessing that many of them came with probably a little deeper background in classical music and so on, as opposed to the background which you had, which was much more varied. Did that ever weigh on you? I mean, did you ever feel like, what am I doing here? I mean, I have a wonderful voice, but I don't quite come from the same cloth as many of these colleagues. Or was that also a case where the blinders became helpful?
Well, I can't say that, you know, everything was rosy for me as far as my, you know, trying to figure out what I would do in this world. I can't say that I thought about anybody else's angst or put myself in anybody else's situation. I thought only about what it was that Angela wanted to do and what was going to make Angela happy. Because if I worried about what everybody else was doing and how good everybody else was, I would be crazy, and I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to put that pressure on me. But I do remember going in to talk to Mrs. Zayani close to the end of my matriculation at Indiana University. And I said, Mrs. Zayani, I'm not sure if I want to be an opera singer. Maybe I'll just sing concerts. I'll be a concert singer. She looked at me flat-footed and says, Angela Brown, if you want to be the next Aretha Franklin, go. You need no more lessons. But if you want to be the best Verdian soprano this world has ever seen, you must work. That was the first and only time I cried in front of Ms. Zayani, because I was feeling very conflicted, because I wasn't sure if this was going to be a good fit for me. But I'm so glad that she gave me those words of tough love, and she made me toughen up and just go for it.
Hmm. That maybe points to something else which you enjoy doing, which is a lot of recital singing and concert singing, and your beautiful CD called Mosaic, which features you singing a wide array of African-American spirituals, and many of them to guitar accompaniment, of all things. I mean, that's about as far from the triumphal scene in Aida as one can get.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that project and the kind of joy and fulfillment it gave you.
Well, it was a project that was definitely from the heart. The Afro-American, well, no, it's the American Spiritual Ensemble, excuse me, out of Lexington, Kentucky, headed up by Dr. Everett McCorvey at the University of Kentucky. They were the ones that produced the CD for me. I'm part of that group, and whenever I have time, I like to go out and sing spirituals with my friends. And so we recorded this little intimate CD there on the grounds of UK and then a church there in Kentucky. And just being able to bring in the fabulous talent that I was blessed to be able to have on the CD. You have Joseph Joubert, who is a Grammy-nominated musician who's playing the piano, who is now on Broadway doing Color Purple. He actually has written some of the music for The Color Purple. He is on my CD playing the piano. And then you have Tyron Cooper, who is a very accomplished musician, guitarist in the area, who is getting his doctorate now at Indiana University, who is playing the guitar. And just to be able to go in and do some organic things with him, because these were not arrangements that existed before we did it. So to be able to have the voice and guitar with spirituals, I just felt was going to be one of the most beautiful things that you could do, and really bring new life and a new look at the spiritual.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful, wonderful collection. Thank you. Soprano Angela Brown in an excerpt from her wonderful album of spirituals called Mosaic. There will be some spirituals sung as well as plenty of operatic arias when soprano Angela Brown comes to southeastern Wisconsin this weekend for her presentation called Opera from a Sista's Point of View. Saturday, May 2nd, 4 to 6 at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in downtown Racine, and Sunday, May 3rd, 5 to 6 at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church, located on Library Square in downtown Kenosha. Free tickets to each of these performances are available at the respective public libraries, both Kenosha and Racine. My thanks to Angela Brown for making time in her busy schedule to join me for the morning show here on WGTD. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and morning show co-host. .857 right now. We have 46 degrees Racine, 44 Kenosha, 42 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. This is the weekly test of the emergency alert system on WGTD, 91.1 FM, Kenosha, Racine News and Classical Music on your gateway to public radio. This is only a test. This concludes the weekly test of the emergency alert system on WGTD 91.1 FM, Kenosha, Racine, your gateway to public radio.
Last night I dreamt you were a glass of Rioja wine we drank on the first night we met.
On the next Fresh Air, singer-songwriter Pokey LaFarge brings his guitar to perform for us in the studio. His new album is called Something in the Water. Join us.
Fresh Air, tonight at 7 on WGTD.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, you're invited to register for the Racine Literacy Council Summer Reading Program. This year's theme is Let's Have a Reading Picnic. Participants will receive a t-shirt if they sign up by June 1st. For more, visit RacineLiteracy.com.
And we're 30 seconds away from 9 o'clock. At 9 o'clock, we join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming. Let's give you the forecast from the National Weather Service. Kind of a two-parter for today. Sunny for the morning hours, partly sunny for the afternoon. Today's high, 57 degrees inland, 47 near Lake Michigan. Normal high this time of year, 58. The record high, by the way, was 83 degrees April 27th, 1962. Once again,